I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, I have a very special guest who is sitting with me in the studio. His name is Thomas H. Schmid, better known around here as Dr. Schmid. If you have ever been a student at the University of Texas El Paso, especially in the English department, you know that he is a professor of literature, and he has been here 25 years, has it been?
Yeah, since 1990.
Wow, and I remember when I started in 2000, you were already here, and yeah. I think we were both looking much younger back then. But you still look good.
Yeah, but we still feel like the new guys.
Absolutely. We always keep it fresh. You are the author of a book called Humor and Transgression, which is about Shelley, the poet Shelley.
Yeah, it's about the Shelley Circle, yeah.
And you are also co-editor of a book called Romanticism and Pleasure. And you are author of a book called A Student Guide to Writing About Literature.
Correct.
Well, you know, people are probably saying at this point, why is he on this show? We don't talk about this kind of work. But in addition to writing all these scholarly manuscripts and writing countless essays on romanticism, and in addition to being a Tai Chi enthusiast, and
yeah,
I think even a Tai Chi teacher as well.
Yes, I have on occasion. Yeah.
In addition to being a professor here at UTEP and being an avid hiker, you just wrote a novel.
I did.
And that's what we're going to talk about today.
Thank you.
The name of the novel is Fools of Time, and it was quite a read. Okay, you're a professor of literature, mm-hmm. and this is a novel about a professor of literature, one who specializes in the poetry of Byron at a university suspiciously similar to the University of Texas, El Paso. The main character is a tenured professor in the English department.
That's right.
Which, as we sit here in the studio, is, you know, just right across the path. But this professor is also a vampire. The vampire professor. Albeit he's a very peaceful vampire, he's kind of like you.
Yeah, he's kind of a good vampire.
Yeah, he studies Tai Chi. He prepares his lectures as if he really cares. But still, he's a vampire. He sucks blood. He sleeps in a coffin. What in the heck were you thinking when you wrote this novel?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking. First of all, a caveat. This is actually not University of Texas at El Paso in the book. It is
yes,
a fictionalized university.
Isn't.
In fact,
and
I even mentioned UTEP.
And I'm going to ask you about that.
I mentioned UTEP later in the book to make it clear that this is fiction.
Yes.
But obviously it does come from, you know, you're a writer. I think writers write from their own experiences.
Yes, sometimes.
And the genesis Absolutely. Of the vampire idea really came out of years of teaching Byron. And, you know, you're probably familiar with Byron's long and ultimately...
Oh, I read it daily.
incompleted work called Don Juan, and he did pronounce it Juan, Don Juan, of course.
Uh-huh.
But Don Juan, which is just hundreds of pages long of out of a rima, you know, eight-line stanzas. It's absolutely brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's comic. It's satiric. And Byron died before he could ever finish it. And I used to always joke for years, I've joked with my classes, that if Byron were still alive, you know, Don Juan would be 8,465,000,000, you know, pages long, because he just would never stop. He was that productive. He was that creative. And so, I don't know, I just got toying with that idea in my mind, and I thought, well, how could I make Byron still be writing Don Juan?
Really?
That's actually the genesis of it. I thought, well,
That's incredible.
I wasn't really that familiar with vampire literature, but I thought, I'll make him a vampire. I thought that would be cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting, because, you know, my impression would have been that it was, you know, you set out to write a vampire novel, but you set out to write something about Byron's unfinished work. That's amazing.
Yeah, kind of. And, I mean, I did set out to write it. I mean, as soon as I thought of the idea of the vampire, then from word one, you know,
right,
I was thinking I had to make him a vampire.
Byron is actually a vampire in this novel, and he is working on his manuscript.
Correct.
That's awesome.
That's right. He's still working on Don Juan. And the other sort of conceit, I guess, I had for the novel as well was that this guy, this kind of schmuck English professor who's a vampire, had fed on Byron many years prior, and that being Byron, he would be a real pain to try and control, because Byron was sort of larger than life. And so I thought that would open up some comic possibilities.
Yeah, and Byron, as a vampire, is always hanging around this professor.
Right.
So, yeah, he's
bugging him. Yeah,
they're an interesting duo. You know, anytime you write a novel, and you know this because you teach novels and you teach poetry and you teach literature, anytime you do that, you open up the metaphorical possibilities. Almost every image is going to have, you know, countless readers trying to figure out the metaphor. And I'm wondering in what ways you might have considered the metaphor of a professor who is a vampire. Is he sucking the blood from his students?
Well, don't want to give too much away, of course, but you know very early on in the book that he has a little rule where he does not feed on his students, right? Because he wants his classes to make, and he doesn't want to diminish the student body too much. You know, I think I had one reader, and I just love this when readers come to you with things that they see in a book. I talk about this in classes all the time, as I'm sure you do as well, that books, in a way, are kind of these Frankenstein's creatures that once they're out there in the world, they don't belong to you anymore. They kind of walk about the world doing their ravages, which is sort of a very gothic conceit itself, right? This sort of ghost text that's out there doing things that you may not have intended for it and that kind of thing. So one reader said to me a while back that she saw this real metaphor of sort of sucking the blood out of books, you know, as a critic and a scholar.
Absolutely. That works for me. Yeah.
Yeah. And but in a good way, right? Books are nourishment. Literature is nourishment.
Yeah. That's interesting that you said that he doesn't suck the blood out of his students. He doesn't kill students. He finds a very, very benign way to feed his necessities.
Right. He tries.
Yeah. What is it like? He buys blood. He has it in his refrigerator all the time. You know, he doesn't have to go out and kill anybody. But what he really loves is teaching.
Yes.
He loves to teach. And anyway, the title, A Fools of Time, comes actually from a Byron poem. Can you talk about that poem?
Yes, actually, it's a play, although you're probably correct to call it a poem. I mean, Byron considered it a sort of mental drama, not something necessarily to be staged. It's called Manfred, and it's kind of this Faustian story.
Right. Let me read the quote that you use. We are the fools of time and terror, days still on us and still from us, yet we live, loathing our life and dreading still to die. It sounds like it's written by a vampire.
Doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of Byron's work, not just Manfred, although Manfred is a very dark, brooding, gothic text. I mean, it's about this man who, like Faust, he kind of seeks incredible amounts of knowledge and sells, you know, doesn't sell his soul, actually. That's one thing that he refuses to do, but he invokes various spirits and ghosts and supernatural powers to help him gain knowledge, all because he has, you know, this is a classic Byronic theme, this sort of high dissatisfaction with himself and with the world. He cannot be at rest with himself. And ultimately in the play, actually, he dies at the very end and dies very peacefully and that kind of thing. But the idea of fools of time and terror, I thought, yeah, it does sound very vampiric. And it's not just Manfred. Another work of Byron's called The Giaour also has a sort of kind of vampiric quality to it. And by the way, I should say that I'm not the first to have written something where Byron's a vampire.
Oh, no.
Tom Holland had a book some years ago called Lord of the Dead, I think, about
a big title.
Where Byron, and it was sort of deadly serious. I mean, it was kind of this interview with a vampire, but with Byron, the main figure, and kind of how he becomes a vampire and all that kind of thing. And I wanted mine to be a little more comic and a little more light and satiric.
Is yours more academic? It's a perspective from a literature professor, and there's some details in this novel that only a literature professor would know about. Like, for example, one of his, the antagonist, I guess you could say, of this novel is a new professor. Her name is Tempest. And let me read a little bit about one of the descriptions of Tempest.
Yeah, she's a bad seed.
I'm going to read not her character description, but something that that your protagonist, how do you say his name? Ruthven?
Yeah, Ruthven.
Ruthven.
Yeah.
Ruthven points out, he says, she had already published some half dozen articles on postmodern feminism, gender theory, and American literature, all in respectable peer-reviewed journals. And they say that God and the devil are in the details when it comes to fiction, and that detail of peer-reviewed journals is something really, frankly, only a professor would understand.
Would care about. Right, yeah.
Yeah. And so that kind of brings me to this question. Even though this is a vampire novel, it doesn't evoke the popular fiction renderings that we have, offerings that we have today of Twilight and things like that. I mean, it really is a very literary perspective, a very literary novel. And so this idea of peer-reviewed journals, I understood it because I'm a professor, and it kind of made me laugh a little bit. But I'm wondering, as you were writing this, most writers of fiction get this question. For whom were you writing? Who did you write this novel for?
It's a really good question. And, you know, I wanted the novel actually to be a crossover. I mean, I was hoping it would have popular appeal and that the arcane literary references and things about the profession and, you know, the Modern Language Association convention where there's photos of Tempest there, you know, all this kind of stuff, that would be obviously very funny actually for professors.
Right.
I wanted this to be something of an academic parody, actually.
Absolutely.
Kind of a David Lodge-y, you know, that kind of idea. But I was also hoping that that there weren't too many inside jokes, and that, or if there were, that they were explained enough that people that aren't familiar with the academic world as much would find them funny. And in some sense, it really is a parody of academic competition, the jealousy between academics. You know, I think there's a point in the novel where Tempest says she's read an article of Ruthven's, and Ruthven sort of perks up because he's so pleased that actually somebody has read
this obscure
academic article, right? And then she says, you know, she thought it was a little bit derivative or something like that, and he's crushed, you know.
You want to get somebody on your good side? Say, hey, I read that article you published in blank, blank, blank.
Right, right, exactly, yeah, because, you know, as academics, and, you know, you're in a little bit different category, but traditional scholarly academics who are writing in peer-reviewed journals and publishing in peer-reviewed journals and things like that oftentimes have very small readerships and that kind of thing. So I wanted that to sort of be a humorous kind of aspect to it. And I hope that people find it so, you know, that, that even readers who are not academics, but if you've ever been around a university, you know these types, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I quite enjoyed the humor. And also, you know, again, considering, since I'm speaking to a literature professor, you know, I like to consider metaphorical possibilities. I don't think I always do this, but Tempest, the antagonist, really, she is what the story is about, his, you know, relationship with her, not a, you know, romantic relationship, I'm not implying that, but their conflict together.
Yeah.
Two vampires, she's a vampire, and she sucks students' blood. In fact, that's how we meet her. She's over there sucking on a student's blood, and he sees her, and it's a wonderful, wonderfully horrible scene. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, the setting, we're talking about being in an English department, and then we're talking about Tempest, you know, which, you know, obviously the reader is going to say, oh, Tempest means storm. And she's a new professor. She's brilliant. She's a feminist. And she is also an expert on, I believe, graphic novels.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
You know, which is really a new field in an English department, an academic field.
Right.
And he's Byron. He's an old white guy who's been there for, you know, I don't know how many years. Are you kind of playing with that metaphor as well, with the, you know, the new English department people coming in writing about graphic novels and then the old guy who's been there for years?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a very perceptive question and point that, I mean, I think, again, I'm not sure I intended to set out to do this, but as the novel started evolving, and as I had this character, again, you know, fiction comes from conflict, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there had to be some conflict between these two, and there's several, obviously.
Well, at least she wasn't a creative writer.
Yeah. Yeah, there's several points of conflict. And, you know, by the way, I myself am not anti-theoretical in any way, but I thought, you know, this guy's been around for 400, 500 years. He's seen a thing or two. And then, you have this very sort of postmodern, very hip kind of professor, young professor coming in who's really sort of challenging his turf in all kinds of ways. I mean, his vampire turf. She's messing around with Byron a little bit, which he doesn't like, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so I just thought that would add a little more conflict to the relationship.
I'm talking to Thomas H. Schmid, whose new novel about an English professor vampire is called Fools of Time. And you were talking about how there's these metaphorical readings that are possible about the English department in a university, the old guard and then the new professors. But you said that one of the things you said is that it was organic. You didn't set out to do that. And as I'm reading this, one of the things that really just immediately made me trust you as a fiction writer is I didn't feel anything was forced. I felt it was all organic. I didn't feel like I was being, you know, that I was being given information or that you had an agenda, but that just you were writing a good story. And because of that,
high praise indeed.
Because of that, the metaphorical possibilities are even greater because we don't lock into parables in this story. We don't say, well, this is about one thing. It's a, you know, it's symbolic of this or representative of that. I mean, it can be. But like in organic fiction, there's all kinds of different readings. And one of the lines that really struck me, and it kind of goes back a little bit to that quote we read from Byron. Your protagonist says, loathing our lives and dreading still to die. That's a vampire.
Yeah.
And I love that because that also seems to open up so many thematic possibilities for life itself, that we loathe our lives, but we still dread to die.
Yeah, we cling. We cling to our miserable existences, right? And yeah, and I think that's, you know, again, I taught Dracula many times, Bram Stoker's Dracula, which of course is the vampire novel. I think vampires have a tremendously strong survival instinct, right? And I wanted to kind of bring that out, right? That they are not going to be messed with, you know. But yet they still also, that there's this sense of sort of being damned,
right?
And even in Bram's, I think I kind of got that maybe unconsciously, if not consciously, from Bram Stoker, you know. There's a scene in Dracula where Mina Harker says to the men who are helping to hunt Dracula, she says, he really is an object of pity. I mean, we need to remember that this man is damned. This man is tortured, you know, as a vampire. But of course, he's not going to stop. That's the point. And they have to stop him, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, I kind of wanted to bring that out. But, yeah.
You seem to know a lot about vampires and vampire history. And I'm wondering, you know, did you geek out on the research? I mean, you bring up a lot of different narratives and little vampire references. Did you do research for this? And I mean, did you really geek out? Because I know a lot of writers, when they research a subject, man, sometimes they just get so into it that they almost become what they're researching. Did you become a vampire?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy the research?
Yeah, I did. I don't think I geeked out on it. I'm maybe ashamed to say that, you know, I didn't really go whole hog, but I knew Bram Stoker's work pretty well. And somebody years ago had given me a book called, it's like called The Vampire Encyclopedia or something like that. And it has some really cool little tidbits in it. One of them was the Chinese vampire, the Changshi. And so I actually put that in the novel that, you know, that every culture seems to have some version. And they're a little bit different. You know, the Chinese vampire isn't quite like Bram Stoker's vampire. But I put that in there. But yeah, it was fun. But what I did not do was read. I confess, I've never read the Twilight series.
Well, it's probably a good thing. Yeah. John Gardner says, don't read anything that's poorly written. It'll influence you.
I don't know because I haven't read it, so I can't say whether it's good or bad.
I mean, can say the prose is pretty bad. I picked it up and I looked at the prose. And I'm sure the plot is, you know, is amazing
fun.
Enough to you know, become
stuff.
A bestseller. But,
yeah.
But the prose is flat.
Yeah. And I did read years ago, I had read Anne Rice's Interview with a Vampire and wasn't
prose too, is a little better
too
in that
crazy
one.
About
it's not
it.
Bad in that one, actually.
So yeah, I mean, I did do a little research into the graphic novel that actually, I probably hesitate to say this, but I'd actually used a real example of a graphic novel originally in the first draft of the novel and ran into actually some copyright issues there with the agent of the author.
So basically you were stealing.
So,
Well, you're a great writer then because
well,
great
I wasn't
writers
because I attributed
steal.
It. No, I actually attributed it.
No, I'm joking. But I know you cite things. You're a scholar. I get it.
And it's a very famous person, yeah. And so I actually got a hold of his agent, and she was like, no, you're going to need to do XYZ and pay XYZ and this kind of thing. It just was, I could have done it, but it was too much trouble. It was more trouble than it's worth.
So
what I did was I made something up.
Right. You know. Yeah, I remember when my first novel came out, I was using lyrics by Dean Martin because my main character starts to, you know, for whatever reason, sing his songs.
How lucky can one man be?
Yeah, and this was Simon & Schuster, and they told me, you know, you either got to get permission or you got to change it. So I just changed it. Whereas with independent presses, they don't seem to care as much. Like when I published with Arte Publico Press and I used song lyrics, they don't care.
Yeah, right. But, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, but this sounds like it was, you know, very popular.
It was kind of a major thing, So I had to, by the way, I also did have real song lyrics in there that I also took out and I made up songs like the Magnetic Strawberry, you know, I just made them up, obviously.
Yeah. It's
originally
kind of fun.
Originally
it was
the Allman Brothers.
Yeah, I got to, yeah. I felt like I got to write Dean Martin songs. So.
Yeah, right.
In your research, well, in the book itself, you bring up Itzamye, which is, I looked this up, the celestial bird in Mayan mythology, but you related this indigenous figure to vampire communities.
Yeah.
Is that your link, or have you read, you know, research that kind of makes that connection?
Yeah, no, that was kind of my link, and that I did do some research in that, as you did, you know.
No, not much. I Googled it.
that's kind of what I did. And then I started reading around. I actually did get a couple of books out of the library about Mayan mythology and things like that. And no, that was my sort of, I just made that up, basically, this idea that, this bloodletting cult, and, you know, you do have these sacrifices, these massive right. sacrifices in Mesoamerican culture. I don't know a huge deal about that, but I thought, yeah, that would be, right. you know, that would make sense to make it be a vampire cult, right?
You know what's interesting about this novel, and we alluded to this earlier, but we're here in West Texas, the University of Texas, El Paso, and other than a university 100 miles or so away, we're the only university here in El Paso.
Yeah,
we're
right.
the only university here in the, would you call it the tri-state area between Chihuahua, New
yes,
Mexico,
you would, yeah.
and Texas, yet you never mention the name of the university. Is there a particular reason why you decided, I'm not going to call it UTEP?
You know, that's a really good question. And yeah, I think I wanted it to have a certain sort of misty quality. I also wanted, by the way, I mean, we can maybe talk about the southwestern landscapes if you want, but I really wanted it to be a kind of love letter, if you will, to this region.
Oh,
and
it absolutely
and the,
was,
and the beauty,
yeah.
The
absolutely.
Beauty of this region, I thought, is a perfect place. If you're a lost and damned soul wandering the night looking for
great
blood.
Great place to be.
West Texas is a great place, yeah. yeah. So at the very beginning of the book, it's like, you know, it says autumn somewhere in far West Texas, and
right.
I wanted it to have that kind of just sort of otherworldly almost quality
right,
to it without
right.
being too definite. I do mention El Paso, as you know, and other places, you know, Casas Grandes
right.
and a few places like that, Hillsboro, mm-hmm. New Mexico. So I wanted it to be regional but not be specific to any one given university.
Do you think that by doing that, by not saying this is El Paso, then that you can have more latitude to create things within the landscape?
Absolutely.
Where people don't say, hey, that's not what El Paso's like.
Right. It kind of freed me up. And there's two ways to go with this, right? I mean, my very good friend Rick DeMarinis, to whom this book is dedicated, a wonderful writer. I just adore
yeah,
Rick's writing.
He was a professor here at UTEP for
he
many
was,
years before I arrived.
For many years, yeah. He actually retired in 1999, I think the year before you got here. And, you know, he has some noir fiction that's mm-hmm. set in El Paso that's wonderful, where he's at, you know, he's talking about H&H Car Wash, and he's talking about,
right.
you know, the Warren Inn on Mesa Street and that kind of thing. And so there's sort of two ways to go, right? One is that you become very specific, and people sort of love that, right? Because they recognize people who are from here, people who have been here. They recognize those sort of favorite haunts
right.
and spots. I just sort of made this kind of decision that I was going to go the other way and make it very sort of indistinct, but
right.
clearly in the area somewhere.
You know,
yeah.
it reminds me of Poe, Edgar Allan Poe, who wrote his detective fiction taking place in Paris. And one of the reasons he's purported to have done that is because American readers at that time didn't really know Paris. And by putting it in Paris, he puts them into a landscape of the imagination.
Yeah.
And
right,
that allows
right.
him to get away with mm-hmm. more, you know, of the less linear details, I guess you could say.
Right.
And if you're
right.
going to tell a vampire story, it's maybe nice to be in a landscape where everyone's not going to have that mode of, okay, where is that? Where is that? Because it gets them to think linear-like and
right.
linear ways. And this way they can just
yeah,
like,
and can seem even more improbable in
right,
a way if you do
right.
it. Whereas if you keep it sort
yeah,
of
yeah, I go to UTEP. I know my professor's not a vampire.
Right. Yet.
Wait a minute. Maybe he is.
Yeah. Yeah. No, no, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, the other thing is, UTEP is a wonderful university. I've just adored teaching here for all these years, and I wanted him to be at some place more obscure than that. You know,
right.
his university is really just Nowheresville, right? You know, that's part of the point, that Ruthven teaches at this very, very backwater place,
right,
which
right.
I don't consider UTEP
right, right.
at all.
You didn't want to depict your own university that way. You would have had to depict no. it as a tier
no.
one.
Right, yeah, exactly, right.
And then you would have got high ratings for your annual evaluation and—
Yes, that's right, Danielle. I was thinking
you know,
about my professional
yes,
activities
you know what you
report
could do?
Form.
You could write a novel that fulfills the university's mission, and that way it'll be, you know, no, I'm joking.
Well, in the sequel, there'll be a group of researchers from UTEP who will destroy Ruthven.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
The other vampire books, you said you haven't read Twilight, which is, you know, an immensely popular vampire book.
Yeah. I should be so lucky.
Yeah. And there have been so many incredibly popular vampire books that have been made into movies, that have become bestsellers, that have become cultural icons.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, as you were writing this, and you kind of answered this earlier, but as you were writing this, did you kind of hope, at least was there some party that hoped, you know, maybe this will be made into a movie?
Oh, absolutely, of course. Yeah, I'm still hoping. You're talking about this in the past, Dad. I haven't given up that hope.
Oh, that's good.
I did want it, hopefully, to have some popular appeal. And even though you're right, it is this academic parody that kind of, and a sort of a vampire parody.
But the plot moves, man. I mean, it moves. I could see this as a movie. You know, one of the things right. that the first basic things that of fiction that I think trip up a lot of people who go from academic writing into fiction is just pages and pages of abstraction. And here I feel like I'm in every single scene. And even if there is information introduced or abstractions that to be explained, they're done through the character. They're done through the body. They're done through through the scenes.
Thank you.
And so, I think that this could be a movie.
One
of the things that writers have to do, and we know this, is they have to promote their own books if they want people to read it.
Yes.
What are you doing to promote this and to make this into a movie?
Well, I'm on Words on a Wire.
It's going to happen. There's going to be a producer.
This is a good start. We did have a book signing last spring, actually, for Mining Books in the English department and that kind of thing. So, you know, this is new for me. This is the first novel I've actually written. So you tell me the way to go. Somebody did suggest, though, that Colin Firth should play Ruthven. So I actually already have specific casting suggestions when Hollywood knocks,
I could totally see that.
Yeah.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with this book. It's fantastic. Thomas, you know, as I start, it was a page turner with depth. And congratulations. And are you going to do another work of fiction after this?
Well, I've actually have broken a little ground on a sequel to Fools of Time. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, in which Byron actually teaches at the same university as Ruthven as an adjunct.
What's it called?
Yeah, so
do you have
haven't come up with a title yet. I was thinking of Sublime Alchemy, but that might be a little too
a little
obscure.
Too sublime and alchemy-like.
Yeah, so it's untitled at the moment, but I would love to. And thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
I'm Daniel Chacon, and I'd like to thank my guest, author of the vampire novel, a professor of Byron and a friend of Byron who is a vampire. It's called Fools of Time, and the writer is Thomas H. Schmid. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you for joining me for another edition of Words on a Wire. We'll see you next week.